Stand up for righteousness. Stand up for justice. Stand up for truth.
I truly believe that thoughts are the greatest vehicle to change.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Victory in spite of all terror. Victory however long and hard the road may be.
To those waiting with bated breath for that favorite media catchphrase, the U-turn, I have only one thing to say. U-turn if you want to. The lady's not for turning.
We do not care whether the cat is black or white, as long as it can catch mice.
Hello and welcome to No Limitations. I'm your host, Greg Robinson from Blenheim Partners. On the show today, I'm joined by Ian Elliott, experienced public director, chairman, and previously chief executive of George Patterson Advertising. Welcome to the show, Ian.
Thanks very much, Greg. It's a great pleasure.
Interesting background, Ian. 30 years in advertising business. Tell us a little bit about your journey.
Yeah, it was a pretty interesting journey. I started life as a truck driver when I left school. And after a year, realised I'd made a giant mistake and that in 6 years of high school, there was only 20 minutes that interested me. And that was when we started a radio commercial and I realised for the first time that people were using different combinations of words and phrases to try to affect my attitudes and actions. And so I thought, well, that's what advertising is about. And I just found that really fascinating. So I was fortunate enough to get a job as a dispatch boy slash trainee at George Patterson Advertising. I didn't know at the time they were the biggest advertising agency in the country, and they were right all through for the 30 years that I stayed there. So I had a pretty good run in the advertising business, and as I say, I was there for 30 years and finished up as the chairman and chief executive for the last few years.
Didn't you retire at 48 as well?
That's right. So I retired at 48 and took the boat up to the Whitsundays and floated around for a while and then realised that none of my mates would come and play with me. And then I got a phone call from John Kirby, who was one of the directors at Village Roadshow. And John explained that he and his brother Rob had about a 30% stake in a small listed printing company in Sydney that wasn't going anywhere. It needed a new chairman. Would I be interested? And so I went along and had a look. And that was a fascinating run for me because I hadn't chaired a public company before, so I had to quickly get my head around the ASX listing rules and all those sorts of things, did the NADC course, and then used my pitching skills to help the business to win a lot of new business. So I got some good organic revenue growth under our belt and then got on the M&A trail and did a bit of a roll-up of some other small printing companies and was then fortunate to find myself after 2.5 years in a position where there were two private equity groups who were in a race to roll up all of the sheet-fed offset printing companies, and I controlled the largest one of those. So I was the great prize, and I also had an offering to buy the second largest one. So in the end, we sold the business to Gresham Private Equity, and it was 30 cents when I started with the business. We sold it for $2.25, so the Kirby's were pretty happy, as were all the other shareholders. So that was my first taste of being a board director, and I really enjoyed it. And after that, kind of got onto the circuit a little bit and was on a board of a number of other companies over the years.
What's been your observations from the boards? I think you said earlier there you were brought on to what, increase sales. Was that part of the mindset in general?
Yeah, I think what John saw is he had observed what we had done with Zenith Media. So we had separated the media buying business out of the George Patterson agency and created this behemoth billion-dollar media buying business in Zenith Media. And so therefore we were going to the television networks negotiating en masse with an aggregated budget of all of our clients so we could get better value by using that bulk to negotiate with the television networks, the newspapers, radio stations and so on. And what was happening with procurement coming into a whole lot of industries was in the printing area. Probably at that time a client like a Westpac had 500 people who had the ability to write an order for printing. But very quickly it was moving to the point where procurement became involved and there might only be 4 or 5 people who could write a printing order. So that sort of narrowing of the sales channel and the aggregation of their budgets and doing large print deals with one operator was the way the business was heading. And so I had that experience out of what we'd done with Zenith, and also a lot of experience in pitching for new accounts. So we had a pretty good win rate at George Patterson's because we really understood the process and the disciplines of pitching to win, which are not necessarily about what's the right answer for the client at the time. What you've got to do is find the answer the client will buy. And then once you've got the client, then you can work on the work that they actually need.
Can we just examine that a little bit more? Because every meeting that we have these days in search and you get to know the chief exec or the chair, the whole focus is around understanding the customer better. Is there a real struggle to really understand the customer better from the corporate mindset?
Well, if you think about the customer in terms of the consumer, or in this case, I was talking about B2B, which is when I would pitch for an advertising account, what I needed to do was to understand the client's need at a very granular level and a quite a diverse level. So if you read my book, Stop Bitching, Start Pitching, what that's largely about is saying, I need to get elected. This is like an election campaign that I'm running to win an advertising account, because there might be five or six people who all have an opportunity to vote. There's a chief executive, a CFO, a chief marketing officer, the head of HR, the head of sales. All of them are involved in the decision, and I need to get every one of their votes. So if I can analyse those five people at a granular level, understand what drives the ball at a rational point, what are their KPIs, so because I need to make sure that I satisfy the needs of all of those five votes in order to get their vote. And so the sales guy has different KPIs to the chief executive, to the HR director. So if I can understand all of those people at a fairly granular level about what drives them rationally, I can make sure that in my presentation I'm delivering a prize to every one of those people. The next part of it is to do a bit of a back-of-the-envelope psychological assessment of those people and say, well, what kind of relationships and what sort of team do I need to put around so that those people would relate best to my team and the chemistry's right between us, our companies, our people, than with one of my competitors? And then finally, I need to understand what's going on at a bigger picture strategic level of what's keeping the chief executive awake at night. Is it some new regulatory changes coming down the pipe? Is it some new technology? Is it some competitive activity? So if I can understand what's going on at a strategic level with the organisation, I can then frame my advertising solution to show how that has the opportunity to not only achieve the advertising requirements that they have, but will also have a positive impact on the strategic outcomes they're looking for. So by doing that, at putting my solution and my pitch together, paying strong attention to each of those three areas, rational, emotional and strategic, I'm very different now to the advertising agency who's come along and answered the advertising agency brief. So if it was a four-horse race, it's no longer a four-horse race. There's three horses and a gazelle, because I'm a different species. So that's kind of what I meant about pitching for big accounts, and that's why we had a fair bit of success with the printing company, because we were able to kind of use that those techniques to win major tenders and get our organic growth up.
Being the gazelle, does the question around price come up? You know, how do you handle that? Because that's the catch 22. You might be the fastest animal in the pack out of those four, but am I going to buy your product?
What I've got to do is I've got to demonstrate value. And so everybody thinks that price is really important, and that's going to be the final, you know, kicker that's going to make the decision. If I can get your product for 3% cheaper than I can get somebody else's product, then the customer is going to go with that. But they don't. The clients go with who's going to deliver the best value. Who do we feel is going to give us the best solutions? Because if I can give you an absolute cracker of an advertising campaign, I mean, I developed the Optus Yes strategy, for example. Now, Optus have probably spent $2 to $3 billion promoting that word yes and bolting it onto the side of the word Optus. So if I can, you know, give them much, much more potent solutions to attract customers, to build trust, build relationships with customers, than some competitor down the road who's going to undercut me. If I can demonstrate that my ability to do that and deliver that other added value, they're going to go with value every time.
And where is the business world or consumer world in regards to building trust and understanding the customer? I know you've mentioned that a number of times.
Yeah, if you're building brands, what you're trying to do is you're trying to build a personal relationship with the consumer so that they feel better about using or interacting with my product or service. And most good brands make people feel good about who they are. And so essentially a brand is a substitute for a human being. And so every brand has a personality. You know, if I said to you Toyota, Mercedes, BMW, Volkswagen, if they came to life as a human being, could you describe them to me? And I'd say, I'd give that question to 10 people and most of them would arrive at almost the same sort of, you know, personality profile. So brands are like people and they all have their own personalities. And when we build friendships, one of the keys in friendship is consistency and trust.
Mm.
So if you see me today and I'm sitting here in a suit and we're having a business conversation, you might have built an element of trust between us. But if you see me on Saturday night walking down Darlinghurst Road with orange spiked hair and a bone through my nose, you might go, hang on a second, he's a bit of a split personality. I'm not sure that I value his advice on the business world as much anymore. So you need that level of consistency to build trust. So trust kind of comes from values which lead to behaviours. And a lot of companies have made certain promises to their customers, their consumers, and they've not delivered on them.
What comes short?
Yeah. And, you know, they promise the world but deliver an atlas. Or they're actually delivering counter to what you expected to get from them. So, for example, you know, the retail stores, or, you know, the major department stores are all bemoaning the fact that, you know, it's not fair because of e-commerce, they're not getting charged the GST, that's why we're getting beaten. That's not why they're getting beaten. They're getting beaten because they don't have everybody standing at the cash register to take the money from you. So the most basic of fundamental disciplines in retailing is when somebody wants to give you money, have somebody there to take it from you. But I guarantee you could walk through any of the major department stores in the city this morning at 11 o'clock and you would see cash registers with piles of clothes on them. And the way that those piles of clothes got there was that Betty got up in Mossman, washed her face, drove into the city, parked at the QVB, walked across the department store, went shopping, found all the things that she wanted, got to the cash desk, there's no one around. Hello, anybody? I've got $1,000 if you'd like to take it. No, nobody, and they walk out the store. So most brands just can't deliver on the fundamentals these days.
So it's got nothing to do with the fear of online then?
I don't think that what's going on with the retail business is so much damaged by online. I think it's they just don't know how to do the fundamentals well.
Mm.
You know, Greg, I've thought a lot about trust over the years, mainly through my business but also through my social activities. And I began thinking about, is there a way that I can help people to get a better understanding about how to build trust, how to maintain trust, and how to regain trust if you've lost it? So I've actually developed a mathematical equation for what I think are the key ingredients that you need to have in order to build, maintain, or regain trust. So recently I was given the privilege of delivering a TED talk at a TEDx event at the University of New South Wales. And the subject of my talk, which I got to choose myself, was the death of trust and its resurrection. Because I've been concerned about the fact that I think never before in our history have we seen trust being betrayed on so many fronts. And I'm concerned about the impact on commerce and on society about this continual dumbing down and accepting of lower and lower values of people and trust being eroded. So here's how I calculate trust. If you do it as a mathematical equation, it looks like this. T is equal to, in parenthesis, A plus A plus A, in parenthesis, multiplied by A. Now that sounds a bit confusing. Let me break that down for you. The first A stands for authenticity. Are you authentic? Are you honest? Are you truthful? So when you're looking at a potential supplier or a customer or a staff member or whatever the relationship is you're looking to have where trust is important, is that person authentic? Are they honest? The next A stands for ability, which is do you have the skills, knowledge and experience to be able to deliver on what it is you're telling me you're going to be able to deliver? And the third A is actions. As I look at your actions, I measure your actions, and I give all of these A's a score out of 10. And when I look at your actions, are they congruent with the authenticity that you say you have, or are they divergent? And when I look at your actions, are they echoing the skills and abilities that you tell me that you have? Because actions are probably the easiest ones to monitor. And you look at actions because out of that comes behaviours. So authenticity plus ability plus actions. I give all of those a score out of 10. So let's say that adds up to a total score of 15. And now I multiply that by the fourth A, which is alignment. And for me, alignment is the most important ingredient in looking at trustworthiness, because I need to make sure that our ambitions and our incentives are congruent rather than being divergent. So in other words, is one side trying to get a greater game out of this particular relationship, or is it okay, we're actually on the same wavelength here? So if I'm in the waste management business and I have a customer that is interested in increasing their sustainability score, if I, as the supplier of that waste management service, am really only interested in my own profitability, then I'm going to send a lot more to landfill. But if the customer is looking for price and sustainability, I need to have my actions congruent with the requirements, the outcomes that that client is looking for. So if I take that back to, let's say, for example, the banks, and I don't want to be a bank basher, but they are pretty easy prey at the moment because the banks have betrayed our trust on a whole range of fronts. The recent Royal Commission has exposed a whole lot of inauthentic values that have been permeating through the banks. We've seen a lot of poor skills displayed. In fact, they're not even very good at covering up their lies and untruthfulnesses. And their actions have been atrocious, and they've certainly been well out of alignment. So if I go back to 10 years ago, let's say before the GFC, I would never have believed that my bank would have been inauthentic, that they would have lied to me, that they were acting dishonestly. But the GFC exposed a few cracks in their authenticity. And then when I looked at their abilities, they were very, very good on abilities. They could get the statements out there. They never miscounted the money. They were pretty good on that. And their actions were also pretty good at the time. But even before the GFC, I was sort of still questionable about alignment. I really thought that they were more in it for them than they were in it for me. Now what's happened is, if you look at what's happened after the Royal Commission into the banking and the superannuation and the insurance game and so on, all of these cracks have been exposed, and we're seeing that people are inauthentic. They've been dishonest at the banks. They've told us lies, and their skills are still pretty good. They still get the numbers right and the statements right, and they don't lose my money. But their actions have been atrocious, and there's very, very little alignment. It's clear to me they are in it much more for them than they are in it for me. So if I apply what I think, how I would rate the banks now, on authenticity, I'd probably give them a 2. On skills or ability, I'd give them maybe a 6. They're still pretty skillful, so that's 8. And then when I look at their actions have been atrocious, I'd mark them down to a 3. So that's an 11 in those parentheses. And then I multiply that by alignment, I'd probably put them down at a 2 for alignment. So they've now got a score of 11 times 2 is 22. If they got a perfect score, that would be 10 plus 10 plus 10 equals 30, multiplied by 10 is 300. So I'm ranking the banks at 22 out of 300 in terms of trustworthiness. So that's how much the banks have fallen through what's been exposed in the Royal Commission. So I encourage everybody that I know now to use that Elliott trust formula, and I'm sorry to stick the eponymous Elliott in front of it, but Michael Porter at the Harvard Business School, that developed the Porter Five Forces model, was my lecturer in strategy, and he really kind of rammed that home to me about the importance of branding your own IP. So if I give people that Elliott trust formula and I tell them to look at their relationships with authenticity, ability and actions multiplied by alignment, but also on a regular basis, take a long hard look in the mirror and judge yourself. Are you being authentic in this relationship? Do you genuinely have the ability, the skills, knowledge and experience to deliver what you're telling this customer you're going to deliver? And are your actions reflective of those values and abilities that you say that you carry? And then multiply that by alignment. Are you really trying to game the system here? Are you trying to get an advantage over your customer? Or is there fairness in the way that this is structured? And the reason that I think that's important that we have a good look in the mirror is that I believe that societal norms are being degraded because there's a constant diminution of values and behaviours in society that become more and more acceptable. And so, therefore, if we all start to review ourselves and try to get a better score for ourselves in terms of trustworthiness, then each day we're kind of auto-correcting and we finish up with a much better society and a much better economy. So when I look at, you know, the Rudd-Gillard government, did we trust them? Their trust level was very low. Why was it very low? Well, first of all, were they honest? Well, there'll never be a carbon tax if we're in power. Bingo. First thing they do is bring in a carbon tax. Were they skillful? Building education, revolution, pink bats. They were hopeless. They couldn't execute. They weren't skillful. They didn't do what they said they'd do. And, of course, they then sold their soul to the independents, the Oakshots and those people, because they wanted to get into the lodge.
Can trust be rebuilt then or something like that?
Well, it's going to be a tough climb out of the hole, I think, because if you look at the process of what's occurred there, generally what happens when trust starts to get breached is when people don't do what they say they'll do, so the behaviours are wrong. The behaviours are often wrong because they're redirected by the wrong REM strategy. Yep. So the incentives are there for me to load up the customer with as many products as possible. I'll lie to them about the fact, okay, you've got a loan from our company, but if you get a loan, you also have to have an account. And if you have an account, you also have to have a credit card. So now I, as the salesperson at the bank, have got commission coming to me on three things. So that incentive structure is what's driven people to behave badly. But what has allowed it to continue is that personal values and good values have diminished. So societal values have dropped and some of these things then become acceptable. So a lot of what was happening at a place like AMP, everybody knew about it. You know, all of the senior executives knew about it, but they said, no, just keep on doing it. Keep on charging fee for no service because we can't do without that revenue and my budget, my bonus, whether or not I get to take my kids to Bali or put a swimming pool in, is determined whether or not I wonder whether or not we make all of these sales. So just keep selling, and they can only do that if they're only if their personal value has degraded. So that's going to be a tough one to resurrect. But if you get good people in there and you take charge from the top, you know, whenever there's a crisis in an organisation, if you hide behind a spokesperson for the organisation or you're not open and honest with your customers from the very beginning, it's really, really hard to rebuild that trust. So if you take as an example, years ago, Arnott's Biscuits went through a crisis because there was a biscuit poisoning. So some person had snuck into the shops, got some ice Vovos, put some arsenic in them, resealed them, and then let Arnott's know that there were a bunch of ice Vovos out there that were poisoned. Mm. And we're going to do it to the rest of your biscuits as well. So Arnott's got on the front foot. Chris, who was the chief executive at the time, became the spokesman. First of all, he went to the police, then he came to us at George Pats. We then put together a strategy for them, a communication strategy, and said, you have to be the spokesperson for the company because the customers will believe you if you're at the front of it. So Chris Roberts got up and he said, okay, here's what's happened. There's been a poisoning scare. We are taking all of the Arnott's biscuits off the shelf. And we made commercials showing them all being swept into buckets. And then we made commercials showing holes being dug at the local tip and the tip-up trucks dumping all of those biscuits into the tip and covering it up again. So there are no poisoned Arnott's biscuits. There are no Arnott's biscuits on the shelf anymore. And until we get to the bottom of this, until we're certain that we can have biscuits for our clients, for our customers that are safe, we won't be back on the shelf. The police got involved. They solved the puzzle. And when the biscuits got back on the shelf, Arnott's had, I think, 50% share, 51% market share at the time. And for the last several weeks, every competitor biscuit had been given a free kick because they had occupied all of that space and people were trying other products. When they got back on the shelf again, Arnott's market share went up to about 53%. So that was the reward for the goodwill that was already in the bank over the years that people had built trust in Arnott's. There's no substitute for quality. The fact that the chief executive was the face of there's a problem and we're going to fix it. And, you know, front foot, honest, and here we are, we're now back again. So the Arnott's got rewarded for that. So it's really important that people are prepared to step up.
Look, you put forward some pretty interesting views there, Ian. And in that regards, from your experience, not only being in advertising and understanding the customer, you're talking about integrity. Now, you've now made that leap from being a CEO into the boardroom. is there enough focus in on the discussion around business? Is there enough focus in the discussion around the quality of the leadership? Is there enough focus around integrity? Because how did it suddenly slip?
Yeah, look, I think the slip has come from not just changes in business, but in things that are acceptable in society these days. I mean, it used to be that you had enormous respect for an ambulance person or a policeman. But now we've come to accept that somebody can swear at a policeman and the guy gets dragged before the beak and the beak says, well, that's not offensive. That's the sort of language the police use every day, so that's not offensive language. So now kids are growing up thinking, well, it's okay to tell a policeman where to get off. Mm. And now we're seeing, you know, probably the most respected occupation in the country, an ambulance person, a triage guy out there in the ambo every day, and they're getting beaten up and people are stealing from them. So you get that degradation in societal norms, and those lowered values seep through into families, then they seep through into businesses, and people are now accepting of lower standards of behaviours.
But do you think business has gone missing in action over the last number of years?
Yeah, look, I think what's happened is there's been such a push for profit results that it becomes profit at any cost. And in order to get profit, you need to drive revenue. And if you want to drive revenue, then you've got to have remuneration strategies that are very focused on delivering always increasing revenues.
But if they would have brought you in day one, you're at George Patch, you would have said, focus on your customer, surely. That will guarantee you the revenue that you're after.
Yeah, well, you've got to build that relationship and maintain that level of trust with the customer, because trust doesn't only give you revenue, it also gives you margin, because people would prefer to pay more for a can of Coca-Cola than they'll pay for RC Cola. They'll pay more for a pair of Nikes than they will for a pair of Slazengers. So they're quite happy to pay the premium for that. And so revenue is important, but margin is much more important. There's not much point in having $1 billion worth of sales if you've got $20 worth of margin. So it's that level of trust and relationship that you build with the customer that is what gives you the margin, and margin is what gives you profit. But there's just this constant drive. You know, it seems that every company has to have growth. You know, nobody's saying, well, we've actually grown to the size of a company we're quite happy with now, and what we're going to do is we're just going to run that along tickety-boo and make a nice dividend to our customers, our shareholders every year. Nobody's saying that. It's all about growth. So then there's pressure all the way through the ranks, and then you tie people's take-home bonuses, their STIs and their LTIs, to the revenue and profit growth and the the EPS growth of the company
and
the TSR. And all of those things drive those behaviours. And because societal norms have diminished and people are prepared to cut corners, they're not trying to jump into the dark side. They just take small steps into the grey, and then they eventually get into the dark side. But you actually don't know that you're in the dark side by that point, because you've just taken a series of minor steps. I mean, if you go back to this whole AMP example, there was a push on to sell multiple products, mm-hmm. and also they were paying for a service that wasn't being delivered, and AMP knew that that service wasn't being delivered. I would opine that if you went back 15 or 20 years, built into the premium was a $5 a month, whatever the number was, service fee that we would continue to update and advise. We'd have a look at your insurances on a regular basis, and if you needed to change it, we would come and recommend something to you. So there was a service fee built in, and that service fee over the years got gradually increased because we needed more revenue, we never knew we needed more profit. And they knew that they weren't actually physically doing anything. They weren't going back to the customer and saying, we've reviewed your risk, and here's what we think you should be changing about it. But it was just a fee that kept on growing year after year after year until it got to the point where it was absolutely vital to the profitability of AMP, and it was vital to the KPIs and the STIs of the senior executives. And so they were quite happy to keep on building that fee in and increasing the fee, knowing that it was a service fee for which no service was being given, but nobody kind of saw it as doing the wrong thing. So It kind of crept in. It just sort of like was got in by stealth. So I think I can kind of understand how they got there. But what should have happened was that somebody should have said, you know what, we're charging a fee for that something that we're not delivering. We should be stopping this.
Whistleblowers.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but you know, it doesn't even have to be a whistleblower. You would think that the average person working in the business looks at it and goes, you know what, this is wrong. We should just stop doing this. But people don't because they're frightened of their jobs and there's so much pressure for growth.
And the culture allows it and creates it. Yep. And it starts to get, we say, greyer and greyer before it becomes very black.
So when I talk about the degradation in societal values, if you look at things, institutions that we used to trust implicitly, the Catholic Church. Now we've seen what's happened with the Royal Commission into institutions, not just the Catholic Church. Yep. And then we find that individual priests get charged, get found guilty, and the Catholic Church don't even fire the guy. And they appeal to the Vatican and the Pope's done nothing about it. So what's that saying to the general population out there about doing the right thing? You know, you look at, you know, people like Rolf Harris, you know, an entertainer we always used to trust. You know, Bill Cosby was probably the most trusted person in television. So, you know, it's just this sort of degradation of societal values. And it's really troubling for me. And I think it kind of has long-term implications for, my grandchildren and their kids, that people accept that this is a new norm. Even you look, you know, the most powerful man in the world, the President of the United States, he's out there telling lies every day. And he's not ashamed of it. He just doubles down and tells a bigger lie again. And now what happens is we look at that and now we just shrug and we go, well, that's just Trump being Trump. And it's good fodder for the late night television guys because it makes some great comedy. Those shows would be half an hour shorter every night if it wasn't for Donald Trump. Mm. But there's the leader of the free world and we've now just accepted that the President of the United States tells lies on a regular basis. So it must be okay because he's still the president.
Am I just a disillusioned customer now?
Well, I think companies have to go back to being able to deliver the fundamentals. So if I think that I'm going to go and buy something from a retail store, I expect there will be somebody on the cash desk to take the money. I expect if I'm not happy with the product, I can take it back and they will say, okay, here's your money back. As opposed to, oh, no, you see, you didn't bring it back within this term. And, you know, if you go to the fine print in our policy, well, hang on a second, mate, I'll pull my policy out. I bought it from you, it doesn't work, I'd like my money back. So, you know, I had an incident with I won't say the name of the company, but they were against Optus at the time. And because I needed to buy a wireless dongle device in an area where my favourite telco didn't get coverage.
All right.
I went to this other group and I bought this wireless device. So I go to the shop and I pay for it and I take it home and it doesn't work. And so I take it back to the shop and I say, this isn't working. Can I get my money back or get a replacement device? No, we can't give you a replacement device here. You have to ring customer service and they will post one to you. Well, what about you just give me my money back? No, we can't give you our money back. But you're the same company. The name of your shop is the same as the name of the company that I'm talking about here. So you're all part of the one organisation. I gave you money. You gave me a faulty product. I expect you will give me money back. Mm. Not give me the runaround, have to ring their 1300 number and be passed from one to the next to the next to the next in the hope that I would die of old age or just get so frustrated I'll hang up. But so if they're not doing those fundamentals, that's where those breaches of trust come in. So companies just have to be able to do the basics.
Are you a good customer? If I do what you say and I actually service you well, am I going to get someone like you back?
Yeah. I'll be loyal to you. But, you know, what happens if it's a service organisation? Let's say it's a restaurant. And restaurants quite often give these little survey forms, you know, say, were you satisfied? On a score of 1 to 10, were you satisfied? I'll say, yeah, I was an 8. I was satisfied. But what is a satisfied customer? A satisfied customer is a worthless asset because a satisfied customer just means the meal wasn't cold when it arrived, the person wasn't rude to me, it was adequate, I got what I paid for. But if you want to be successful in retail or in restaurants, anything in hospitality, you've got to do something to absolutely wow your customer. So,
particularly when you think about our country is a service country. Yep. That's where our business is now.
Yep.
So are we wowing the customer?
No.
So we're adequate.
Yeah. So if you go to most restaurants, it's not cold. They're not often rude to you. They're not over the top polite to you because Australia has that whole sort of egalitarian thing. So, you know, we're not servile. And we also don't work for tips as much as the Americans do. So in order for me to say this is a 10 at this restaurant, they've got to do something that absolutely knocks me out. But most restaurants, you know, you go to a restaurant, five or six times in a month, and you've given them your name when you arrived, and they've welcomed you by your name. Yes, Mr. Elliott, I'll get you a seat. But the next time I walk in there, they don't recognise me.
Mm.
But when they say, oh, yeah, welcome back, you know, would you like the table you had last time? You start to feel a little bit special because I can't really judge whether or not that was an outstanding steak or an over-the-top 11 out of 10 steak. But what I can judge are these relationship things. I can judge how I'm treated. So I think, you know, you've got to really knock people out these days if you want to become repeat and loyal customers, because there's just too much competition. There's too many other places I can go to. So I always say to my clients, what are you going to do to wow your customer? What's going to really knock them out? I'll give you a good example. A mate of mine's a guy called Steve Ackery, Stefan the hairdresser in Queensland, right? Stefan owns the largest privately held hairdressing chain in the world, most of it in regional Queensland. I think he's got about 75 salons now around Queensland. And Stefan came to Australia as a young Lebanese kid at the age of 10 or 11, goes to Adelaide with mum and dad, gets picked on, you know, the garlic breath, the whole bit. This is back in the 50s. Mm. And Stefan becomes a hairdresser because his grandfather was a hairdresser, his father was a hairdresser.
All right.
And before he left Lebanon, his grandfather said to him, Stefan, the only thing you need to remember is the heart that gives is the heart that gathers. The heart that gives is the heart that gathers. So Stefan goes through school, gets a job in a salon, has his own salon, sells that, gets in his little MG and decides to drive around Australia. Finds himself in Longreach in outback Queensland. Walks into a pub, orders a beer. There's only one other bloke at the pub down the other end of the bar and the barman. The barman looks at him, he goes, what do you do, mate? And Stefan says with his strong Lebanese accent, I'm a hairdresser, mate. He said, really? He said, well, finish up your beer and buzz off.
Step outside.
You know, the bloke at the end of the bar overhears this conversation. He sidles up to Stefan. He said, you're a hairdresser. Stefan said, yeah. He said, well, you know, I own a shop in town and the young girl who was the hairdresser there got behind in a rent, couldn't make it work, and she's done a bunk and shot through, left me with the unpaid rent, but she's left all the equipment in the salon. Do you want to rent the salon? Stefan says, well, I'll have a look at it, mate. And the bartender said, mate, you're wasting your time. So Stefan goes along and he does a deal and he takes on the lease of the shop. So turns out the barman was right. Nobody came. Nobody walked into his shop. So he goes for about a week and he hasn't got one customer. So he goes back to what his grandfather had said to him, the heart that gives is the heart that gathers. And he takes himself up to the local nursing home and he introduces himself. He says, matron, you know, I'm a hairdresser. I've got any customers. I don't want to lose my skills. Would you mind if I came in and did some, you know, scalp massages, the odd perm, a blow wave, whatever? She says, knock yourself out, son. So Stefan goes in and does all of that.
Is this a true story?
Yeah, right? True story. Next day he goes to the hospital, says the same thing, and now he's getting to know the locals. So that night the family come in to see Auntie Mabel, and there she is sitting up there in a twin set and pearls and the purple hair all coiffed and looking beautiful. They say, Auntie Mabel, what happened to you? She says, I don't know, some guy from town came in and did this for free. So Stefan just kind of ingratiated himself with the local community. Anyway, I retell that story at an SME conference on the Gold Coast about 10 years ago. And a woman is waiting to talk to me after I get off the stage. And she says to me, you know Stefan, do you? I said, yeah. She said, well, you know he has the promotion where your first haircut in life is free. I said, yeah, I do. It's a lovely idea. It's a lovely gesture. You take your baby along and their first haircut in life is free. It's a lovely warm gesture, but it's also a very smart business move because Brilliant. You think about the lifetime value of a customer. They get their first haircut, they get their 101st haircut, they might get their 1,001st haircut. So the lifetime value of a customer. So she said, yeah, you know, you've got this promotion where your first haircut in life is free. So we took my granddaughter to his store in Ipswich and the girl there did a lovely haircut and we were so thrilled with it, we took a photograph of my granddaughter and we sent it to Stefan with a nice thank you note. I said, well, I know he would really, really appreciate that. She said, you know what he did with the photograph? I said, no, what? She said, he sent it back. She sent it back. I said, I know he's been travelling a bit, but, you know, Rose, who works with him, would have picked it up. I'm sorry, I don't very often tell people that I don't believe him, but I'm sorry. There's no way he would have just sent it back. She said, he did. He had it, sent it back, photographically reduced and encased in this 18-carat gold locket.
Is that right?
With a note that said, your granddaughter is so beautiful, she should be kept close to your heart at all times. Love, Stefan. Now, that's a wow moment. Now, I don't know, maybe Stephen buys these things by the gross. but absolutely wowed this woman. And she's told 1,000 people, and probably in conferences correct, around the world, I've told 100,000 people. So
Where wow examples have you seen?
Well, where you create wow moments is about being thoughtful and being ahead of the game with the customer. So if you think about why is this customer involved with my product or my service, what are they really trying to get out of it, and what can I do to really knock them out? I'll give you an example where I got wowed.
Yeah, give us an example which was a difficult product then.
Well, if you're looking for great examples of wow moments, go no further than the five-star hotel industry, because they train their staff with fabulous systems. They have great processes and systems that allow the staff to have some autonomy and flexibility in the way that they service the customer. I'll give you two examples. In fact, in this one I'll give you is a Virgin Airlines example. I was in the middle of a board study tour in the US, but I had months before signed an agreement to go and do a speech at NIDA to a group of startup companies, and it fell in the middle of that study tour in the US. So I fly from San Francisco to Mascot, get off, get in the limo, drive to the NIDA at Kensington, yep, do the speech, go back to the airport, get on the plane, go back to San Francisco. So as I'm getting on the plane back to San Francisco, I'm flying to LA and then to San Francisco, and I'm with Virgin. And the guy behind the desk is checking me in, and I've only got my drag along with me, right? I've left all my other clothes back in San Francisco with the rest of the board. So I've only got this drag along bag. And he says to me, Mr. Elliott, would you mind if I just weighed that bag? Because, you know, we have a limit on how heavy luggage that goes in the overhead compartment. I said, sure. So I stick it on. It's like two or three times what it's supposed to be because it's full of board papers and all sorts of things. So he said, look, I'm really sorry. I'm going to have to check that. I said, well, look, I'll just take my laptop out and you can check it through. I only need my laptop. So I put my laptop under my arm and I've got the cord, the PowerPoint lead, tucked under my arm with the laptop, and I wander off to go and do a bit of duty-free shopping or whatever, have a drink before I get on the plane. And when I get to the door of the aircraft, the guy who's checked me in is standing there. And he said, oh, Mr. Elliott, he said, I've been looking everywhere for you. He said, when you left the desk there when I checked in your luggage, he said, I felt really bad watching you walk away with the lead and the laptop under your arm. So I went and bought you this laptop case, still in the plastic. It'll be much easier for you to carry, right? So this guy has thought about, it's interesting. You can see that I'm a VVIP customer. I'm a club member.
Right.
And so he's thought about it. And he's thought, well, that sort of doesn't – looks a little bit cumbersome for him. But he's not only sort of smart enough and forward-thinking enough and customer-centric enough, he's shown some initiative, but God bless him, Virgin have given them that latitude to be able to go and buy something like that and make that investment. He doesn't have to go and put it in a fill in something in triplicate and carbon copies and so on to get an agreement a month's time that I buy me a laptop case. So this guy delivers the laptop case to me. Now, that's a very small thing, but it just sort of knocks you out. And Virgin continue to knock me out, I must say. The job that John Borghetti has done with Virgin Airlines and customer service is world class. And I've often said to John, I reckon there's something in my folio that when I check in, it's got a little sign that pops up that says, beware, this man is actually John Borghetti in a fat suit. But, I mean, they are astonishing.
What's your story regarding first class service in these first class hotels?
Well, as an example, I went to a conference in about 1996 at the St. Regis Hotel on corner of 5th and 53rd, 5th Street in New York.
Didn't see the purple head lady.
No. And I was a nobody. I was like the general manager or managing director of George Patterson Sydney at the time. I wasn't a speaker at this conference. I wasn't anybody important. I just blew in one day, checked in, threw my bag in the room, went to the conference, next morning checked out and flew home. So I wasn't anybody important in that hotel. Fast forward another couple of years and I get appointed chief executive of George Patterson. 2 days after the press announcement goes out about my appointment, I get a letter from the St. Regis Hotel in New York, the nice gold stamp on the back of it. And there's a letter there addressed to me and personally signed by the president of the hotel that says, "Dear Mr. Elliott, I read with interest in yesterday's issue of the Wall Street Journal of your appointment as Chairman and Chief Executive of George Patterson. May I congratulate you on what I'm sure is a well-deserved promotion and hope that when you next visit New York, you'll once again choose to stay with us here at the St. Regis." Wow. Talk about blowing me away. Now, I know it's a trick. I know that there is a system that has... that he's not actually been sitting there with his feet up on the desk reading the Wall Street Journal.
He's personally signed it as well, Ian?
He has personally signed it. It wasn't one of the electric person ones. Mm. But I know he wasn't sitting there with his feet up reading the Wall Street Journal. And you're like, "Hey, Beryl, Ian's got a new gig in Sydney. Love, bring your sword handbook in and I'll send him a note." I know that there's a system that cross-references the appointments column with all the people who've ever stayed at the hotel and spits that out. But what does that say to me? It says that they care about me as a person. And if they can do that, I'm pretty sure that they can get a cappuccino to my room while it's still hot. So that sort of speaks volumes about the place, right? It really sort of blows you away. So there's a great example where technology has been employed to be able to create a wow moment. The other area where technology is employed is that they have systems which, when you go to check into the hotel, if you've stayed there before, you say you have a reservation for Elliot, and they say, they look and they put ELL, up pops the reservation. Elliot, red flag, says, has stayed with us before. So the greeting is, "Yes, Mr. Elliot, welcome back to our hotel," or "welcome to." And so they spend a fortune getting that phrase right, "welcome to" or "welcome back to." Now, back in the 90s, I go to the Shangri-La Hotel in Singapore, and I'm there on business. I'd stayed there 20 years earlier as a free independent traveller on my way back from Europe with my wife. And again, I was nobody important in the hotel. This time I get out of the limo after getting back from the airport. The guy gets my bags out of the back. I walk to the desk. I look at her and I say, "You have a reservation for Elliot." And she says, "Yes, Mr. Elliot, welcome back to the Shangri-La."
20 years later.
And I look at her and she hasn't even looked down and gone tap, tap, tap into the computer. And I think, well, there's no way that she could remember. And even... Now, they wouldn't have gone, even if she was looking at a computer, they wouldn't have gone back 20 years and put all those individual details in there. So I said to her, "How do you know that I've stayed here before?" She said, "Oh, Mr. Elliott, the management have explained to us how important it is to be able to welcome back our returning and loyal guests. So welcome back." I go, "Yeah, but I need to know how you know that I've stayed here before, because you didn't even look down and go tap, tap, tap." She said, "Oh, I can't tell you. It's a trade secret." I said, "Well, look, if you don't tell me, I'm going to take off all of my clothes and I'm going to run around the lobby here squawking like a chicken until you tell me." So she smiles and she says, "Okay." She said, "Well, when you got out of the limousine, the bellman took your luggage out of the trunk of the car." I said, "Yeah." "And he said to you, is this your first time at the Shangri-La?" And you said, "No." And he tugged on his right ear and I saw. So the staff have worked it out between them. So... that's a great example of ask your staff and your customers because they've got all the answers. They threw the challenge out to the staff and they just worked out a system between them. So you can forget about the millions in technology that everybody else has developed to be able to go back and do the tap, 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 up comes the flag, he's been here before. They just worked out that little thing between them.
So when you sit as a board member these days and you look at senior executives walk in and present, and they present and they talk through the data analytics and where the customer is at, what do you really see?
I see some empirical evidence of how the customer is behaving and transacting with us. But what I'm much more interested in than transactions is repeat purchase. So it's not a business isn't about transactions, it's about traction. It's about how many times they come back and buy from you. Because it's very expensive to go and find a new customer. It's much cheaper to get a lot more out of an existing customer. So I'm happy to look at the sales numbers and look at the number of new ads, new customers we've got, but I'm much more interested in looking at how many repeat purchases and what activity are we undertaking in order to include those people to become loyal to our business. So, profit comes from repeat purchase more than going out and having to have a conquest sale every time.
And does business actually ask for the business enough? Now, the Americans seem to be exceptionally good. If you ask for a hamburger, they'll say, "Would you like this special cheese, blah, 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 blah." And next thing, "Would you like a can of Coke? Would you like this?" They're great at add-on sales.
Yep.
Where are we in that regard?
Australians aren't natural at selling up. We're not good spruikers, if you like. But in a lot of businesses, people have spent a lot of money on training people to get better at that. So I think we're probably at about 60 or 70% of where the Americans are. But don't forget that the Americans get paid in the service industry are much, much lower wage, so they're working for tips. So they're trying really, really hard to, you know, win the customer and upsell and, you know, give a better experience. And I think we probably need to invest more in training our people on the greater subtleties around giving outstanding customer service.
The wow factor.
Yeah. And again, it comes back to being thoughtful and being ahead of the customer. So, you know, you go to a hotel in Singapore and it's stinking hot outside. You go for a run around the block. When you come back, there's a guy there with an ice-cold little towel at the door. Yep. There you go. I thought we might like that. So that's just that little bit of thoughtfulness of being ahead of the game. But I think, unfortunately, a lot of people don't spend enough on training. And I remember getting into an argument with the chief executive of our global company because at George Patterson's, we spent probably as much as the next 10 advertising agencies on staff training as the next 10 agencies did collectively. So we were very heavy into training and, you know, we did train people really well. And they wanted me to cut the training budget, like basically just decimate it, cut it down to about a fifth of what it was. And I refused to do so. And he said to me, "But Ian, what happens if we train all those people and they leave?" And I said, "Well, what happens if we don't train them and they stay?" So, you know, you've got to put the effort in. And there is an art to good customer service. It's not about being servile and yes, sir, no, sir, and I'm tugging my forelock as I back away from you like I'm somebody out of Upstairs, Downstairs or Downton Abbey or something. It's really about just giving exemplary service and being thoughtful about what the customer's needs are.
But what about the cost of sales? If you think about, I think you mentioned early, the banks.
Mm-hmm.
When was the last time you actually walked into a bank to do a transaction? Or are you going to do it online, Ian? And if that's the case, how do you engage and how do we get this wow factor?
Well, I'm with Westpac Private Bank and I had a very happy relationship with them all through the last decade. But I can honestly say I haven't spoken to anybody at the Westpac Private Bank for 3 years. So I had a private banker and I would ring Caroline and say, "Can you transfer some money here? Can you do this?" You know, whatever it was. And they were very good at it. But since the arrival of internet banking, I haven't had those conversations. So I haven't spoken to anybody at Westpac Private Bank for 3 years, but I'm more loyal to Westpac today than I was when I was interacting with a human because they've anticipated what my needs are and they've given me a way to do it online whenever I want to do it, 24 hours a day, from anywhere where I want to do it, on whatever device I want to do it from. And it's always accurate and very intuitive, so it's a very easy online banking system to use. So I will be loyal to Westpac as long as they continue to deliver that quality of service because I'm getting what I need from the bank. It doesn't have to be somebody being polite to me. Now, you know, they will send me some things in the mail and, you know, American Express send you things in the mail, invite you to an event or whatever. So that's all very nice. It makes you feel pretty special. And even if you don't go, it's a nice thing to be invited to. At least I know there's somebody there I'm not so egotistical, like sit there and think that they're all sitting there remembering my name and putting it on an envelope and addressing it to me. We better invite Ian to that thing. It's electronically generated. But at least I'm being recognised in some way as I'm in a category that's being made to feel special. I'm with a group of people that's being made to feel special.
What about Ian, when you walk into a supermarket and you get a choice of going through the self-serve or the two or three lanes left for people serving you with a queue of four or five deep? Where do you go?
I hate the self-service checkout because the damn things never work. They've always got to have some person there with a little card that they swipe it automatically because the bananas didn't ring up or whatever. I just think that's the height of arrogance. They will try to convince us that the reason they've got those self-serve checkouts is because it's fast. You don't have to wait in long queues.
But isn't it the same as your experience with Virgin? Are you doing it online as well?
Yeah, but no, I don't do online supermarket shopping. I still go to the supermarket.
Okay.
So they will try to kid us that the reason that they do that is because now we've got more options and we can get through the process much quicker. Well, I say, well, just add some more checkouts, mate. You know, I want that personalised service. I want to put those things on the conveyor belt and watch them go along and then get them into the bags. And so I'm against those. I don't think that's an added plus. Probably the express checkout lane is an additional service that I would value because if I've got 20 items or less, I can get through quicker. I've only got a pint of milk and a pie or whatever it is. So that works, but the bit about forcing you to do it yourself because they've only got one or two checkout people on it at the main registers is I just think the supermarket's hiving the cost base onto me to do what they should be doing.
And when you have your board meetings, does the topic of building trust and really understanding the customer come up enough?
It does because, in a lot of the boards that I've been involved with, they're financial transaction businesses, and so if you're giving somebody money or looking after their money, you have to have a high degree of trust. And so you've just got to be absolutely squeaky clean and ethical in everything that you do and make sure that the customer never has a reason to doubt. Because all you need to do is just give them a reason to be a little niggling thought that, I'm not really sure about that. I saw how that moved from there to there, but I don't know whether or not that was completed. So you just never leave anything out in the process that could give them doubt. Because when people are left wondering about something, I always love that expression, which is, in the absence of information, the brain automatically defaults to the worst possible conclusion. So if I don't know what's going on, I think the very worst. So, you're out there with your kid at the Westfield and you're walking through with your three-year-old and suddenly you look down and he's gone. Your first thought isn't, oh, little bugger, I'll bet he's gone over there to the Harvey Norman store to watch the Wiggles on the big screen. That's not your first thought. There's an absence of information. You go immediately to the worst possible conclusion. So the more that you can keep people informed and not give them any areas where they might have cause to doubt, then the more that you maintain that level of trust.
And is there enough giving from the heart, to use your terminology about what Stefan used to do from corporate Australia?
I think a lot of corporates tend to write checks to assuage their guilt as opposed to, I really want to do something to make a difference. I think it's more important to do things at a granular level with people. I like corporates who give their staff an extra a day off a month to go and work with a charity and to get like really, really close to the end recipient of the benefit. I'm not one who's strong on saying, let's write a check for 100 grand to the Smith family or something and we'll just trust that they'll look after it. I live up at Potts Point around the corner from the Wayside Chapel, and so you see some pretty sad cases. So I've adopted a few people, homeless people and addicted people and so on, and helped to mentor them along. And I get a lot of enrichment out of that relationship that I have with those people as opposed to just writing a check for 10 grand to the Smith family and think, well, I've done my bit. So I think corporates need to, use their power to be able to create greater outcomes that are closer to the customer of the charity. You've actually got to go and find a cause and get right up close to those people. So if you want to help a battered women's refuge, you need to go along to meet the people who work at that battered women's refuge. You may or may not, because of privacy things, not get to meet the woman that you're actually helping, but you'll work with the person who runs the battered women's refuge, and she will tell you about an individual who needs help, and here's her story, and here's how that 2 grand would be applied to help to change that person's life. It's going to mean that you can have, pay for running of a car and a rego or whatever it might mean. So that kind of level of proximity to the end user is something that I think makes a big difference. And I think that's the solution to regaining more trust in society by getting people closer to people who need help, and they can see that it's not very far from, the penthouse to the dunny. So people need to realise how quickly your life can change. And, the bulk of the population out there are only a fortnight away from being on the street, because they've all got credit card debt, they've got mortgages, they've got rents to pay and so on, and they live week to week, month to month. And so people just kind of need to appreciate that it only takes a slight hiccup where you can be right out of step and life's not so great.
Then you really bring some unique views for discussion and to the table. Who do you see sets the tone for this type of thinking in corporates?
I do think it starts with the board, and it's not just about having a board policy that gets published and stuck up next to the elevator and here are our values and our missions. And
does anybody really look at those?
There it is. So we've done our job of communicating. What you need is to have interaction between the board and the senior executives, and hopefully with the broader staff. The best boards that I've been on, you know, we get on our bike and we go to all the different locations where we have businesses around the country. And every time we go there, we have a crossfire with the staff. So the board will set up on some stools and there'll be 300 or 400 staff in the office. And we'll say, now you can actually ask us any question that you want. There's no, nobody's going to get in trouble for asking what you might think is an embarrassing question. You ask us the question and we'll give you the very best answer that we can give you. You know, I always love that expression, ask your staff and your customers because they got all the answers. But so few people talk to their customers enough and so few chief executives will go to their staff and ask them for ideas. Because their ego says, well, if you're the boss, you should know all the answers. If you, that's then going to be a sign of weakness that you've gone to the staff and said, I'm devoid of ideas, because that's what they think it's being translated as. Have you got any ideas? That's being translated as, I've got no thought. I've got no idea what to do with this company. Give me your thinking. So you've got to put park your ego on the side, because the staff will always come up with great initiatives. And if you keep on talking to your staff and your customers, then you know, you'll get the answers that you need, because the staff are the ones who know what the customer's needs are and the customers know what it's going to take to continue to get their loyalty and repeat purchase. I also remember, by the way, that there was a Bain consultant and Harvard Business School professor called Frederick Reichelt who wrote a book called The Loyalty Effect. And what The Loyalty Effect was, it was about demonstrating that there was a clear link between staff loyalty, customer loyalty and shareholder loyalty to profitability.
Yeah.
So people always think, well, if you look after your staff, they'll look after the customers and the customers look after the shareholders. And that's absolutely right. But what he brought it back to was, if you've got shareholder loyalty, then you've also got greater profitability, because what that is about is, if you've got shareholders who are in and out of the stock on a daily basis, just trying to, you know, make a penny either way,
yeah,
then you've got a very volatile stock price. Whereas if you've got shareholders who stay for a long time, you've got stability in your stock price. So therefore, you can start to plan for a capital raising that you might want to have, and you know roughly what you're going to be able to raise that money at a point in the future, because you've got a fairly stable stock price. So that thing about shareholder stability is an interesting one for me. And so you've really got to try to build a shareholder base where you manage their expectations. And again, this comes down to communication. So they need to understand, is this a you know, a stock that I'm looking to get a capital gain on, or is it a dividend play, and how regular are the dividends going to flow, and is the business going okay? Because, you know, I think there are probably a number of businesses out there that shouldn't be going for any more growth, because the growth is probably going to come at a lower margin, and they then get voracious about trying to get another 5% market share. But what that does, it then starts a price competition with your next nearest competitor. And they'll always point the fingers at each other. It wasn't me that started the price war, it was the other bloke. And then your margin shrinks and your profits aren't there. So if you get a shareholder group who are satisfied with a good dividend, a good yield, and it's a stable company, then that then can become a very healthy investment. And then what you're doing is you're continually working on the cost base to find ways to use technology to reduce your costs, as opposed to wanting to get conquest sales where I'm killing off an opponent by slashing the price to get them in the door just to get revenue up. So if we just come back to your question about whose responsibility is it to rebuild that trust, I think it starts with the board and it starts with the chairman. And the very beginning point of that is the board and the chairman exhibiting behaviours to the senior leadership team and the chief executive that demonstrate that values are important and that ethics are important to the business. So we're here to do the right thing by people, not just to try to find a way to cut a corner. And so for me, that's about how does the board interact with the senior leadership team and the chief executive and with the staff they get to meet as they walk around the offices. That whole thing about leadership by walking around is important. So if the board demonstrates...
Do you see enough of that?
No. Everybody just seems to be so busy. And quite often I've seen boards where they schedule in a state board meeting and all that happens is they fly in, all the staff get excited because the board are coming to Brisbane or wherever the meeting might be, you know, and they polish up the depot and all the rest of the stuff. And the board flies in, walks into a boardroom, into a meeting room, closes the door, has a meeting. Oh, we've run out of time, we're back to the airport. And that's debilitating for the staff. That's disrespectful. So, that interface with the staff is an important thing. And if I can just sort of finish on one issue about boards and chairs and their relationships with chief executives. A lot of people think that the chairman shouldn't have a close relationship with the chief executive. There should be a level of distance between them because they don't want to be so friendly that it's now pally and the guy's now starting to cut the chief executive a little bit of slack because I know he's got a mortgage and his mother died last week or whatever it happened to me and I'm feeling sorry for him, so I won't push him too hard.
Or he won't make the tough decision.
Yeah, yeah. So you then sometimes get a cold relationship between the chairman and the chief executive because the chairman is worried about building a warm relationship with them. My view is that the chairman should be the absolute cheerleader for the chief executive. That chief executive needs to feel as though the whole board have got their back and they believe in them. And you keep on backing them until you sack them. And so if you demonstrate a level of warmth and understanding between the chairman and the chief executive, that I'm here to help you to achieve your numbers and achieve the strategy of the business, then I think that the chief executive is much more motivated by that level of encouragement than by fear. And so too many businesses, I think, are run on fear these days.
So, Ian, does that then lead to the chief exec continuing that philosophy throughout the organisation?
Yeah, because if the chairman is warm and supportive and the board are warm and supportive to the chief executive, that then becomes the standard for the organisation, and the chief executive is then warm and supportive of his senior leadership team and they're the same with their staff. So it's all about running on encouragement rather than running on fear. So a lot of boards and chief executives walk around trying to catch out people doing the wrong thing. I'd rather walk around trying to catch them out doing the right thing and complimenting on having done that.
Well, Ian, thank you for sharing with me and the audience some great stories and terrific examples of how to build trust with the customer. Whether as the person on the shop floor or the CEO of a major organisation, I certainly have enjoyed it and will be putting your ideas into practice. Again, thank you. You have been listening to No Limitations.